Welcome to Rights Watch, a program about human rights around the world from Human Rights Watch. I'm Amy Costello, filling in for Jesse Graham. This is the show for August 3rd. Today we take a look at the reign of former Ugandan president Idi Amin. He was accused of killing some 100,000 people during his eight-year rule. After Amin fled into exile, Ugandans never went through a formal reconciliation process. Most of those accused of carrying out the mass killings and myriad human rights abuses never faced trial. Author Andrew Rice has written about Uganda's violent past and contemporary post-Amin culture in his new book entitled The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget, Murder and Memory in Uganda. I sat down and spoke with Andrew Rice about the journey of his book's central character, a man named Duncan. He's the son of a prominent village chief who was a political opponent of Idi Amin. When Duncan's father was picked up by Amin's army in September 1972, he was never seen or heard from again. Duncan would spend the next 30 years on a quest to track down those who executed his father. It was a quest that culminated in a Ugandan courtroom in 2002, where three men were standing trial for the murder of Duncan's father. There is a very gripping scene in the murder trial when your central character, Duncan, takes the stand and begins to describe the moment when he began to uncover the bones of his father that had been buried, and he had been searching for them for years. And as he begins to describe that moment, the judge interrupts him and tells him that this story that he's telling has no place in the criminal trial of these three men. "We stick by the books," the judge said sternly. And I'd like you to read the excerpt that follows that.
This was not the vindication Duncan had expected. One of the assumptions that underlay all the recent experiments in humanitarian justice, the Truth and Reconciliation Commissions, the United Nations Tribunals, the International Criminal Court, was that the truth possessed cathartic power. The proponents of these new legal mechanisms spoke of traumas and burdens, ghosts and demons, language that evoked the European tradition of the psychiatrist's couch, and religious rituals like penance and exorcism. Duncan wouldn't have described his motivations quite that histrionically, but he did believe it was important to speak the truth aloud. More valuable to him than any conviction or punishment was the prospect of making a record, official and indelible, of the circumstances of his father's death.
Did Duncan succeed in his quest to make a record of the circumstances of his father's death in that courtroom?
Well, yes and no. I think that Duncan himself would tell you that the court didn't give him, eventually, ultimately, the thing that he wanted. The thing that he wanted was some kind of moment that would, in a way, crystallize or memorialize what had happened to his father. And that wasn't and isn't and probably shouldn't be, in a society with the rule of law, the function of the court. You know, the function of the court is to try people and determine if they're guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not primarily to make the survivors of crimes or the people whose family have been victimized by crimes feel some sense of closure. Sometimes that's a secondary thing that occurs, but it shouldn't be, I don't think, the purpose of a justice system. The purpose of a justice system should be to seek justice.
At points throughout your book, you talk about the fact that Idi Amin, had he ruled 20 years later, the outcome of his reign and the way it was dealt with may have been very different. And I'd like to look at and have you read one excerpt about that fact.
If Idi Amin's regime had fallen in 1999 instead of 1979, Amin might have been extradited to The Hague, like Charles Taylor or Slobodan Milosevic. But instead, the exiled dictator was living well in Saudi Arabia, forgotten by the world.
How important is the role of the International Criminal Courts in sending a message that human rights abuses will not be tolerated in terms of fortifying post-conflict nations where human rights abuses have taken place?
I think it sent an unambiguous message that the quote-unquote international community won't stand for this anymore. The question is whether that statement by the international community will necessarily have a deterrent effect on the behaviors of people in areas of conflict. And I think it's very difficult to say at this juncture that it has.
I want to end by talking about the post-trial environment that you explored. What I sensed in this book was a lack of remorse on behalf of the defendants, particularly the primary defendant, Major General Gwan. You visited him several times in prison while he was awaiting trial, and it appeared to me that certainly he failed to acknowledge that he had a direct role in the killing of the central character. But furthermore, he seemed to lack remorse and even acknowledge any atrocities that he committed during the reign of Idi Amin when he was a high-ranking general. And you go one step farther. We step back from Major General Gwan, and you look at the population as a whole. And I'd like you to just read that excerpt.
No one in Uganda took responsibility for Amin's crimes. Southerners blamed the Northerners. The Northerners blamed the Nubians. The Nubians blamed those Sudanese, Amin's foreign mercenaries. Each individual deflected the burden of guilt away from himself, his friends, and his tribe, shifting blame forever outward in radiating circles of denial.
That's a pretty devastating characterization of post-Amin Uganda. And I'm wondering, what are the ramifications for the lack of anyone taking responsibility for the atrocities that were committed during the reign of Idi Amin that lasted 8 years and claimed at least 100,000 lives?
You know, Uganda has chosen that policy of sort of just seeking peace and trying to move beyond things. And at least superficially, it seems as if that has been a successful strategy for the country. On the other hand, the question is basically whether this has created a sort of negative precedent that teaches the current leadership of Uganda and all future leadership of Uganda need not worry about future consequences of their actions, however abusive they may be. And after Amin fell, for instance, many of his henchmen fled. And when they were gone, they were out of reach. And so the populace, when they looked for people to blame, they blamed Muslims because Amin was a Muslim. Many of these people were killed, lynched. There were terrible massacres.
Massacres of Muslims after Amin's departure because Amin was a Muslim from that region. And so there was retribution against his people, so to speak.
Yes. I mean, basically the idea that individuals commit crimes and groups pay for them. I think one of the problems that Uganda will face in the future is that because they've not had any kind of real reckoning, and because there hasn't really been a coming to terms with Amin's legacy, because of all this blame shifting that goes on, I think that they now see Amin's legacy in terms of group participation rather than individual crimes. So I think what you see in the end is that if you don't have some sort of individual accountability, you do end up seeing negative consequences for larger groups of people, many of whom are innocent.
Andrew Rice, author of The Teeth May Smile, But the Heart Does Not Forget, Murder and Memory in Uganda. Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
Next week, we'll explore Uganda's present-day human rights record. We'll hear the latest on that country's notorious Joint Anti-Terrorism Task Force, which has been accused of enforced disappearances and routine torture.
The victim said task force personnel beat them with guns, fists, whips, canes, chairs, and boots.
A look inside Uganda's notorious Joint Anti-Terrorism Task Force next time on Rights Watch. Human Rights Watch is an independent organization dedicated to defending and protecting human rights around the world. For more about us, including audio, video, and multimedia features, please visit hrw.org. Thanks for listening to Rights Watch. I'm Amy Costello.